Well, brothers and sisters, it is so good to be here with you, and I'm going to step down. I'm not a podium type of kind of guy, and they did go to try to find the handout. I did have a handout for you, so hopefully they will get it. If not, I will go find a copy center somewhere on campus, because I know they must have them, and those that would like a copy of this presentation, we'll be able to have that for you by lunch, right after lunch, if they don't find the copies. Grateful to be here, as I mentioned, and the sad part is that we're all here because we've lost somebody that we love. I've been doing this grieving conference since its conception, and was part of a small group as an original. Let me just give you a little original piece, if you would. Back 10, 11 years ago, I had six widows that were poorer than church mice, and they'd all lost their husbands, and all of them were under the age of 40. They had 28 children between them. And these poor sisters, as they came, I understood that they really couldn't afford therapy, and so what I did is I decided to do a grieving group. And out of those six widows, they decided that they needed to do something bigger and better, and they organized what you now know as the Widow Widowers Conference, for the LDS Widows Widowers Conference. They call themselves the SOWs, okay, the six original widows, okay. I thought that's quite a name to give yourselves, but they're just wonderful, wonderful sisters that have made happen what you see here today. And the way that I see it is it's just going to get bigger and bigger and better as time goes on. I'd like to help you understand the grieving process. That's why we're here today in this particular class, is to help you understand what you're going through and help you understand what you're going to go through even more as time goes on, but even more so to help you through it so it's not as painful, it's not as hard, because it is hard. Grieving is work. Number of years ago, it's actually been about 22 years ago, I was contacted by a mortuary in the town in which I resided. And they asked me to come and do a grieving group. I told them, I says, you know, I'm brand new at this grieving stuff, don't really know anything about it. And the mortician's wife says, well, that's okay, I'm gonna be with you and teach you. And after we finished the first 8 weeks of the session, she said, you know, Kent, I really love what you're doing here with our group. Would you go back and be certified? Would you go back and be trained in the art of helping people grieve? At that point, I went to Colorado. I went through some schooling there. It took me about six weekends to go over to Colorado, and I did that. And for the next 17 years, brothers and sisters, I've been doing lots and lots of grief work. And 10 years ago, so it's now been 27 years since that happened, my mother passed away. And when my mother passed away, as I remember that morning, I was the family member that was the contact person when my mother was so ill in the hospital. And I remember walking away from the hospital that morning, and I was thinking to myself, Kent, you're a paid professional. You know how to grieve. This isn't going to be that tough. And then I learned what grieving is really all about. And I want you to know that as a grieving therapist, a counselor doing that sort of thing, I didn't know anything about grieving, absolutely nothing. With that, I wrote two definitions, and I'd like you guys to write those down if you could. When we find the handout, it is written on the handout, but since the handout isn't available at this moment, we'll do that. But here's the two definitions I'd like you to write. The first one is the definition of loss. Loss is when we lose hopes and dreams that are core to our existence. Loss is when you lose hopes and dreams that are core to your existence. Now, other than working in my practice with individuals who get divorced, none of them wanted their spouses to go away. I've never had a man, I never had a woman come into my office that lost their spouse to death, that wanted their husbands to be dead, or their wives to be dead. Understand that, like what I found, is I started to live life after my mother's passing. What I learned is that everything in my life, my mother had been a part of. Of course, she was there when I was born, okay? But every birthday, every birth of my children, the day that I was married, the day that my children were born, everything that went on, my mother was part of, okay? She was part of my hopes and my dreams. When I got married to my wife, Susan, I want you to know that all of my hopes and my dreams were based upon that marriage. I want you to look at your lives. Okay, every one of us, okay, we think that what we're going to do is we're going to go on through life, we're going to get married, we're going to live happily ever after. We do live happily ever after, but this life, there is an end. I don't know how many of you have really thought about death. My thought is that I want to die before my wife does. Okay, her thought is that we're going to live to be 78 years old, and I don't know why the number 78 is there, and then we're going to do a Thelma and Louise off of the dam by which we live. Okay, but we don't think about that. But in my mind, my dreams, my hopes, everything that I have, brothers and sisters, says that she's going to be part of my life. When my children got married, she's going to be there. When my grandchildren get married, she's going to be there. We're going to have vacations. We're going to go serve missions. All of those things are part of the hopes and part of the dreams that we have. Then what happens is we get onto the other end of that and we lose the one part of our life, and now we can't have those hopes and dreams any longer. That's pretty tough. That's pretty hard. So, definition is when we lose hopes and dreams that are core to our existence. Okay, the next definition is the definition for grieving. Grieving is the process we go through, and I've had clients that have told me it's the process or the knothole that God drags me through that helps us let go of, she sent the wrong thing. Okay, now we're back on track. So it's the process we go through that helps us let go of old hopes and dreams and helps us obtain new hopes and dreams. So in other words, what we do as we're going through this grieving process, brothers and sisters, is we're letting go of things that we can no longer have, and then we're establishing new hopes and dreams of things that we can have. In other words, now the definition again, it says it helps us let go of old hopes and dreams, and it helps us attain new hopes and dreams, things that we can now have. Now, two parts of the definition that I want to focus in on that we're going to continue here. So you ready for the next half? It's an unlearned process. There is nothing in life that prepares us for loss. Okay, there's some of you here that your spouse was sick before they passed. I want you to know that it's still hard. You knew it was coming, but it was still extremely hard. Pardon me? It's an unlearned. Unlearned. It's an unlearned process. There's nothing in life that prepares us. There's nothing that prepares us to do that. What I know is that as I've gone through numerous passings of individuals that I love in my life, at this point now, because I'm getting older, what I know is that each one is hard. Each one is painful. Okay, the next piece is really, really important for those of you that are thinkers. Okay, it's a feeling process, not a thinking process. It's a feeling process, not a thinking process. You cannot think your way through it. The reason that you can't think your way through it, brothers and sisters, is because it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, time. She's saying that time doesn't exist, it goes on. But where my thoughts now for you go is it doesn't make any sense, and so you can't think your way through it. And so what we do is we go over it in our minds, and we go over it in our minds, and we go over it in our minds, And in a minute here, as we talk about it, then what happens is that makes us feel bad all the time. Now, the handout is coming, and so just hang with me while I talk to you about what we go through. Now, what I want to do is I want to take you through a cycle that we go through. And again, I apologize for the handout not being here. In the handout, what it does is that we have a little cycle that we go through that says we are going to experience trauma. Is there anybody here that did not experience trauma when your spouse passed away? I want you to look around, and even though there's maybe 40 of us here in the room, nobody here, everybody here experienced trauma. When you have trauma in your life, what it does is it creates a tremendous amount of stress in your life. Is there anybody here that has not gone through stress since the passing of your spouse? I want you to look around. Everybody, we're still experiencing, and we have that. When you have that stress going on, what it does is it numbs your brain. All right? So as we go down this little cycle, it goes trauma, then over to stress, and the stress comes down and it numbs our brain. Literally what happens to us, brothers and sisters, is that when we have trauma like that happens, it goes in and it kills what we call dopamine in the front lobes of your brain. It's a chemical. That dopamine dies, and then you have what we call short-term memory loss. Any of you here have experienced any short-term memory loss? Now you know why. It's because of that trauma. When you're in the middle of that, the next thing that you look at is you go and say, we've got trauma going on and we have short-term memory loss, and it creates in us what we as therapists call triggers. Triggers are emotional memories that are created by your senses. Your senses are touch and taste and sights and sounds and smells. And as we have those triggers go off, okay, an emotional memory, what it'll do is it will create anxiety. Any of you here felt anxiety in since the passing of your spouse? Okay, everybody here has experienced it. When you go into anxiety mode, okay, adrenaline hits your system, it makes your heart race, it makes your stomachs churn, it makes your chest go tight, it makes you fearful, it makes you want to run away, it makes you want to just go zone out, you just don't want anything to do with anybody. It has those kinds of feelings that it brings. And when we're in that state, brothers and sisters, we misread life's cues. We literally misread life's cues. So here's what happens. Because we've had some trauma, our minds have gone numb, we've now got the triggers, the trigger goes off. Now, the trigger could be something very, very simple. Okay? You can walk into a room, you ladies that are here, and you can smell your husband's cologne. Bam! A trigger goes off. All of you can be driving down the road, and you're listening to the radio, and on comes your favorite song, or on comes songs that came back from the era that you grew up in. And all of a sudden, there's a trigger that goes off. Okay? You can be sitting in your home, and even though it's one of your children coming, it could be coming in the same time that your spouse came home from work, and as they come in to visit you at your home, you'll think, he's here, or she's here. And a trigger goes off, and it creates that what? It creates that anxiety that's there. So as we're going through this little cycle, it goes around and around and around, and let's just take you to Thanksgiving for a minute. Okay, you're going to have Thanksgiving. For those of you that are living in the United States, in Canada, I've got some folks from Canada here. There they are. Do they have Thanksgiving in Canada?
We celebrate
earlier. You celebrate earlier. We need to take that one and keep yours and keep ours, and we'll celebrate twice. But at Thanksgiving time, you've got five senses, and as you go to Thanksgiving, which has normally been a family affair, and we're going and we're eating good food, so we got the taste going and we got the smells going, and there's my family, and we got all the chitter and the chatter going on, and we got all of those wonderful things happening, but guess what it makes us feel like? Lonely, anxious, I don't want to be here. You'd be surprised of how many clients that I have over the years that have come, and they tell me, I can't stand the holidays. Okay? I tell my clients, you know, don't do the normal on your holidays. We've got some over on this side too, Kim. Okay, and so we have those holidays going, and the holidays bring on a tremendous amount of stress on us. Okay, we don't like them. But last year, or the year before, when our spouse was still living, realized that you did like those holidays, and that's what I'm saying. Now we're misreading life's cues, because everybody else is having fun. Guess what we don't want to do? Because why? Because our spouse is not there. Okay, we have Mother's Day coming up this weekend. How many of you, is this your first Mother's Day without your spouse? Okay, you're going to be dreading come Sunday. You're already dreading, and it's not your first. Oh, and she's even got on the 7th, which is Mother's Day. No, that's Saturday. Okay, so Saturday she's got her anniversary, and then the next day is Mother's Day, so she's got a double whammy. Okay, so it's hard, and I just want you to know that. I want you to understand what it is that you're going through as you're going through these things. Now, one of the things that I tell people, and this isn't one of the fun parts of my presentation, but the first year you go through life and it's tough. It's hard. What we know is that the second year is worse than the first year. The second year is. Okay, and she's saying, why is that? The reason being isn't because the second year is actually hard, but you remember last year. Okay, the first year you're going through it and you're having all of these little anniversaries that come along that hit you and all of these triggers. The next year is hard because you go back and think, oh, it was so terrible and horrible and rotten last year, and you have a tough time. What you do is you'll find that the next year isn't so bad because you're going to go through the second year and you're going to say to yourself, oh, I was expecting this and this and this to happen. It didn't happen. It wasn't so bad. And so the third year around, it's not as tough. It's not as hard. But that's the reason that you have such a tough time the second year, is because you remember what happened last year. What I want to do now is I want to teach you some concepts that'll help you, okay, be able to get through these first 2 years of grieving. All right, here we go. Because of it was missed in the handout that I had. Nope, you're good. You can sit. Here's a concept that I would like to teach you, so you'll need to write. Each and every one of you, and I'm going to take you back in my learning, because in the most of my career, I've practiced now for about 29 years, most of my career, brothers and sisters, I deal with sexual abuse. 17, 18 years ago, one of the general authorities called me to Salt Lake. And he said, Brother Allen, we don't have anybody in Ogden that we trust to do work with sexual abuse. We hear that you're a pretty good therapist, and I want you to go back, and I want you to be trained, and I want you to let me know when your training is completed in working with sexual abuse. After this next 6 months, I flew to California every other weekend. I wish the church would have paid for that, but they don't. And I went to California, and I was trained in dealing with sexual abuse. What happened to me, though, brothers and sisters, over the next 17 years is that I became depressed because of what I dealt with. 40 to 45 hours a week, I would have little children in my office that I was dealing with that had been sexually abused, and that's pretty hard work. What I discovered is the reason that I was depressed was because of what I heard every day of my career. Realize that for you, what I'm about to teach you is another thing that happened just like with me. What I learned, brothers and sisters, is that I learned that my agency had been taken away. Now, there'll be some of you that will say, well, what do you mean my agency's taken away, Kent? Your agency's taken away, and the fact is that how many of you here really wanted your spouse to pass away? Unless they were in extreme pain by cancers, or they were in a coma, or they had dementia or Alzheimer's disease. How many of you really wanted your spouse to pass away? My experience is that most people were praying for a miracle. Most people don't want their spouse to pass away. And all of a sudden, now what's happened is your agency has been taken away. What happened to me is every time a little child would come in, every time a teenager would come in, every time a woman would come in, that had been raped or sexually abused, understand I had to sit and listen, okay, because I wanted to help them. And every time I sat and listened, guess what it did to me? It took away my agency. For you, the same thing has happened. The concept now that I want to teach you is I call it 6 steps to taking your agency back. Here's what they are. Step number one. Step number one is you have to recognize when your agency is gone. You have to recognize that your agency is gone. Okay, I'm working with a lady that a year ago now, her husband went out to go fishing. They have no idea what happened. All they know is that he fell into the reservoir and he drowned. They found his boat going in circles. They have no idea how and what happened to him. There was nothing that showed up on the autopsy that said why he passed away, but he died. As she came to visit with me a couple of months ago, I asked her a question. I says, how does it make you feel when you think about your husband's passing? Okay? She said to me, Kent, it makes me feel really bad. And then she said, I could say that it makes me feel really crappy. Now, when you feel sad, when you feel alone, when you feel abandoned, when you feel frustrated, when you feel angry, when you feel those feelings, guess what's gone? Your agency. Tune into your body. Tune into what it's trying to tell you. Okay? When your agency is there, we're usually happy. We usually have some joy in our life. We usually are pleasant. Life is good and you feel peace. When your agency's gone, it feels just the opposite. So tune into your body. Step number one, recognize that it's gone. Step number two, very, very powerful when you learn to do it. It'll take you about 2 weeks to learn, but when you learn to do this, what happens is there's a mighty change. What you do now, step number two says, you choose how long you want to feel that way. You choose how long you want to feel that way. A wise man once said that we can't choose what happens to us, but we can choose how we allow it to affect us. He was a prisoner of war in Nazi. He was a Jew. He lost his whole family. Okay? But we can choose how we make it feel. Under step two are 3 steps. Step number one says, allow yourself to feel. How should you feel if your spouse passes away? Crappy. You should feel bad. You should feel sad. Realize that that tells you how much you love them. When you miss them, you know, those are all signs, brothers and sisters, that you care, that you love them. Allow yourself to feel. It's not a bad thing. If you get mad at them because they're not here, guess what I'm going to tell you? That's okay. It's okay to feel. None of those feelings are a sin. Okay, if our Savior was perfect because he felt all of the feelings, if our Heavenly Father is perfect, he's felt all and he's feeling all the feelings, understand that it's okay for us to feel those feelings too. It's important because grieving is what kind of a process? A feeling process, not a thinking process. Allow yourself to feel. B, under 2, says, it says then that you have to literally choose how long you want to feel that way. Literally choose. And C says it has to be in real time. Real time comes in minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades, centuries. You decide how long you want to feel that way. Okay, what we don't want you to do is think, and feel until you become depressed and despondent. Okay, I had a lady that came to our grieving conference last year. Her husband had only passed away 2 weeks before the conference. And as her daughter came in and introduced her and her mother to me, I said, oh, my dear girl, you probably shouldn't be here today. Okay, 3 weeks later, I put that lady in the hospital. Okay, for a suicide attempt. Okay, wasn't a good thing for her, because guess what she was doing? Thinking and thinking and thinking and feeling and feeling. What I want you to do is I want you to think or feel, I want you to process, I want you to feel, but I want you to do it in short increments of time instead of great big long periods of time. So literally choose how long you want to feel that way. So there you go. So you can see how it works. You're driving along, you hear the song, you have the trigger, now you've got the feelings going on. Okay, you choose now how long you want to feel that way. What I'm hoping is you'll say is, I want to feel that way for just a half hour. I only want to be that way for an hour. If you've only got 15 minutes, then I only want to be that way for 15 minutes. So that you're literally choosing how long you want to feel that way. And you'll notice that I used real time. I didn't say I want to feel that way for a while. I want to feel that way for a few hours. Don't know what few means. It has to be in real time. Now, we go to step three, and it'll tell you why. Step three then says, cut the time in half. I want you to cut the time in half. So if you want to be sad for 15 minutes, I want you to cut it in half to 7.5. Now, let me explain why. The reason we do that, brothers and sisters, is because when we're going in and we live in life one of those spectrum scales where it goes infinitely in each direction, and we're going to call the spectrum emotions. In your life, you cannot not have emotions. Just so you know, research tells us you cannot not have emotions. We're living in a life that has positive emotions, and we live in a life that also has negative emotions. And you're going down through life, you've got all of these positives going. You can walk into your home, and you walk into your closet, and there you see, you know, your spouse's clothes. There's a trigger. Okay, everything that happened that was positive today is now gone at the snap of a finger. If you're driving down the road and you're having a good time and you're whistling to the music and all of a sudden there comes your favorite song, bam, it's gone. And it's gone in a fraction of a second. The negative side of the spectrum doesn't work that way. I cannot go and snap my fingers and feel good instantly if I've got sad going on. Any of you can do that? Didn't think so. Okay? The negative side, the research tells us that it's 7 times more powerful than the positive. In other words, for every negative you have to have 7 positives to replace it. I'm not going to give it that much power. I'm going to say it's only got half as much. You cut the time in half, because you're going to go down that negative side, and let's say that you want to be sad for an hour. You're going to go and you're going to be thinking negative thoughts for 1.5 hours. Okay? You stop it, and we're going to teach you how to do that here in just a minute. And then it takes you 1.5 hours to get back to neutral. Okay? Before you can even start to build a positive. That's why we cut the time in half. Now we go to step 4. Step 4 says, set a timer. Literally set a timer. Is there anybody here who does not own a cell phone? Everybody's got one. And if you've bought one in the last 7 years, and if yours is even 7 years old, every cell phone that is made has a timer on it. I want you to use your cell phone. I want you to go onto your cell phone. I want you to find the most obnoxious ringtone that is there. Okay? And that's going to be your tone, that when this bell goes off, that it's going to be there to say, stop. Now, we do it for 2 reasons. Here's the 2 reasons. Number 1 is that there's a law that is a God-given law, and it says when an object is in motion, it will remain in motion until something of equal or greater value stops it. Guess what your mind is? It's an object in motion. And she says it's greater than any object out there. Okay, but it is an object in motion. The average person thinks at 400 thoughts a minute. The experts tell us that if your mind is anxious, you're clicking along somewhere between 8 and 1,200 thoughts a minute. Now, at 400 thoughts a minute, brothers and sisters, that's 24,000 thoughts an hour. That's 576,000 thoughts a day. And your mind will just keep right on going until something of equal or greater value stops it. So if something happens as you're driving down the road and you've got a 5-hour drive to get to St. George, guess what you're going to think about for 5 hours? Okay, if you ladies are watching, because I know none of the guys here watch this, but there's this thing called the Hallmark Channel. Okay, if you women are out there watching the Hallmark Channel, it's going to remind you that you're single. You know, your mind is going to go right on through the night and all the way to whatever is going on tomorrow before your brain clicks back in and says, I've got to focus on whatever. Your brain will do that. It will not stop until something stops it. The timer is that something that stops it. And after a few times of doing what I'm asking you to do by having and listening to that obnoxious ring, it becomes the little bell that Pavlov used to teach his dogs to salivate. It literally becomes a cue for you to stop, and it'll stop you. I want you to know it really works, because I've taught this to thousands of people, and guess what they tell me? It works. I had one lady that said, I'm going to prove you wrong. She came back 2 weeks later. Nope, it proved her right. Yep. We think at 400 thoughts a minute. That's like, wow. Okay, now, continue on. So the timer goes off, and now we go to step five. Step five says, think a totally different positive thought. Now, because, well, there might be some. Is there anyone here whose husband or wife passed away less than 3 weeks ago? Okay, nope, everybody there is there. What we know, brothers and sisters, is that your mind, after 2 to 3 weeks, is not thinking anything new. Okay, we want you to think a totally different positive thought. Understand that your mind now, when you think about your spouse, guess how what you're thinking? You're thinking the same things. You're thinking the same thoughts that you thought yesterday. You're thinking the same thoughts you thought 2 hours ago. Every time you think about those things, how is it going to make you feel? Sad? Bad? Hurt? Lonely? Angry? Frustrated? Okay, it's going to create those same feelings that it created before. Okay, now there's this wise guy, his name was Albert Einstein, don't know if any of you have heard him. His definition of crazy was people who do the same thing over and over again expecting different results. If you think the same thing, guess what you're going to feel? And 5 years from now, when you're thinking the same thing, guess how you're going to feel? You will feel the same unless you change. So I ask you to think a different thought. Now, I need to tell you the story about little Jake, who helped me understand this concept. Little Jake was a little 8-year-old boy, okay? It's been 11 years ago now that he taught me the concept. Little Jake, on a Saturday morning, his dad got up. His dad was actually the bishop of his ward. He loved his little boy, and he got up on Saturday morning, and they got up and they had breakfast together. Every Saturday, this man would get up and he'd fix his two children breakfast of pancakes, and he'd put M&Ms and he'd put Skittles or he'd put Reese's Pieces in them. And him and Jake got up that morning and they had breakfast together. They went in and they watched cartoons for a little while. And then Jake's dad got up from watching cartoons and said, Jake, I'm going to go for a bike ride. When your mom and your sister wake up, let them know where I've gone. Dad went out, got on his bike, went on down the road. 45 minutes later, there came a knock on their door. It was the highway patrolman, letting them know that Jake's father had run a stop sign on his bike and ran out in front of a dump truck and was run over. He did not survive. Little Jake had OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and in his mind, he believed that anybody that I love that leaves me is going to die. And he couldn't let his mother and his sister out of his sight. Everywhere his mother went, he went. He went to church with her. He went to Relief Society with her. He went to do various everything with her. The mother shared with me that when she had to go to the bathroom, he would sit outside the door, and if it took too long, he'd be knocking on the door. Are you okay? You okay? You okay? You okay? He would sit out the side of the door when she showered and do the same thing if it took too long. Jake then began to think that anybody that rode bicycles is going to die, and he stole a pocket knife from his grandfather. And every time he saw a bicycle that didn't have a rider on it and didn't have anybody around, he went over and, unbeknownst to anybody, he started popping tires so that people couldn't ride their bicycles. He got in big trouble for that one. At the end of the summer, Jake had to go back to school, and he had to leave his mother. So the first week of school, what happened is his mother would take him, drop him off at school. Before she could get home, the phone would ring, and the principal would say, "Jake's curled up in a ball, and he's screaming, and he's having a tough time. Come get him." After doing that for 5 days in a row, the principal then said, "You really need to get some professional help," and that's where I came into the picture. I used to try to get people to think about positive thoughts about their loved one who had passed on. It wasn't working really well for me, just so you know. And I have no idea why that day I said to Jake, "Jake, I want you to go home, and what I want you to do is I want you to follow this little process, and your mom's going to help you, and then I want you to think a different positive thought about something that you love." Well, Jake and his mother came back to therapy 10 days later, and they came in, and like most little Mormon moms, she came in, and here was a handful of a plate of brownies, and on the other hand was this big plate of chocolate chip cookies, because she didn't know which one I'd like the most. She come in, she set them down on the receptionist counter, and then she came around the corner, and she gave me a big hug, and it really embarrassed me, and then she said, "You've saved my life. Jake's better." And I'm thinking in my mind, nobody gets better in 10 days. So I put him into my office, and I went in. And as they came into the office and I sat them down, I looked at Jake and I said, "Jake, what you been doing that you're so much better?" He says, "Mr. Allen, I'm just doing what you told me to." Now, little OCD kids are very obedient. And he said, and I says, "Well, what you been thinking about?" He said, "Hamburgers." I said, "Hamburgers? Hamburgers is making you happy?" And then he went off telling me about how he loves hamburgers and he thinks about eating hamburgers. And then I said to Jake, I said, "Is that the only thing you've been thinking about that's positive?" He says, "No, hamburgers isn't my favorite thing to think about." And I says, "Well, what's your favorite?" He says, "I love to go fishing with Grandpa." I says, "You do? And how often do you go fishing?" He says, "Every week." And I says, "Well, what happens when you go?" He says, "We have contests. And whoever catches the biggest fish or the most fish wins the contest." And I says, "Well, who usually wins?" He says, "I win all the time." And I says, "And what's the prize if you win the contest?" And he said, "We get to go eat at our favorite place." And I says, "Where do you get to go? What's your favorite pizza place?" He says, "Pizza's not my favorite food. Or hamburgers is not my favorite food. Pizza is." Okay, what Jake was doing was now thinking of what? Hamburgers and Grandpa and fishing and pizza, and guess what he's not thinking of? He's not thinking about his dad getting run over by a dump truck. And within a very short period of time, guess where Jake had gone? Okay, it's been a year ago now, I received a little card in the mail from his mother that Jake is now serving in the Jacksonville, Florida mission. Pretty cool. And he's doing great from what I hear. All I'm saying now, brothers and sisters, is that you change the way you think. And as you think those thoughts, what it will do is it will give your mind and it will give your body a chance to heal. Tomorrow you're going to think that 3 or 4 times. The next day you're going to think that 3 or 4 times. The next day you're going to think and do that 3 or 4 times. But what happens is you do that 3 or 4 times a day, that what happens over a period of time, guess what you do with your grieving? You work through your grieving. But now we're doing it in minutes and hours instead of a half a day, all day, or all weekend. It's one of those things, brothers and sisters, that if you try it, it'll work. And now I got to take you to the sixth step. The sixth step says, as soon as you can, do something different. In other words, you can't be still doing the same thing that you're doing and expect to get out of this downward cycle that you're in. You have to do something different. All right? Now we're going to shift. Last page, it talks about Dr. Chatelain's theory of stress, or there's a reservoir theory of stress. And I want you to picture on the board up here, okay, this giant picture of a reservoir. Would you do that for me, please? Now, with this theory, what I would like to do is I want to compare each and every one of you to a reservoir. I live on a reservoir. I live on a dam. They call it Pine View. Don't know if any of you have ever been to Eden or Huntsville. That's where I live, right above the dam. The dam man lives in my ward. That's what my kids used to call him, was the dam man. Okay, and then they found out that he controlled the waterfall at the bottom of Ogden Canyon. For anybody that had ever been to Ogden area, there's a waterfall that's beautiful. It's man-made, okay? And then they started calling him the waterfall fairy because he'd sit at the bottom of the canyon with a little remote. He'd let the water in and out and decide how big the waterfall is going to be. And so they started calling him the waterfall fairy, and he says, don't call me the waterfall fairy. I want to be the dam man. So they all still call him the dam man. Now, what this dam man taught me one day is we were talking about the reservoir. His name is Mike, so I won't call him the dam man anymore, but I'll call him Mike. What Mike taught me is in that little reservoir, that dam that we had at our in our valley, is that in the springtime, before that reservoir fills up, that he could drain the reservoir completely in less than 2 weeks without flooding the river and the canyon below it. In the spring, like right now, okay, it's almost full. There's only a foot more to go. When that reservoir is full, he says it would take me two and a half months to drain that reservoir without filling or flooding the river. Okay, when that reservoir is full then, what I'm saying to you is that it's really, really hard to drain it quickly. When it's low, you drain very, very quickly. So now you look at yourself and you're that reservoir. Okay, there's some of you here today that I can guarantee you that your reservoir is very, very low. There's some of you here today that probably have nothing more than a puddle in the bottom of your reservoir. And when life stressors come along, because they come each and every day, when life stressors come along, how quickly are you going to be drained? Very, very, very quickly. Sometime before you go to bed tonight, I'm going to give you two assignments today, actually three. Okay, assignment number one is to sit down, and I want you to write out the things that stress you, that drain your reservoir. Now, because we want you to participate a little bit, I want you to just yell out, if you would, the things that stress you.
Money.
What else? Pardon me? Children. Loneliness.
Bills.
Keep going. Laundry. Okay. Disappointments. Cars.
That other people aren't grieving about it.
Ahead of you. 30 years ahead of you.
Yeah.
Future. Future would stress you out.
Being single
again, and LDS, and having to go to church on Sunday in a family that is family-oriented and teaches family stuff, and everybody's sitting there with their families. Church stresses you out. That's probably the hardest day of the week for most people. Other thoughts?
Yard and garden
and children. Okay? As you look at these things, realize that they're stressors, and I need to let you know that the research tells us that you can't eliminate your stress. Okay, if you have children and if you got rid of your children, guess what that would cause you?
More stress.
More stress. Okay, I've been told, I've never had it, but I've been told people who haven't had money and then had money, it was more stress having money than not having money. I'd like to have that stress just to see. Okay, but they tell us that you're just exchanging one stress for another. You really can't get rid of your stresses. The theory that I want you to look at now says that what we're going to do is we're going to raise the level of our reservoir. In other words, we do things to fill our reservoir. And what happens when we lose our spouse is, guess what we stop doing? We stop filling the reservoir. We stop doing the things that we used to do that made us feel good.
Like shopping for your spouse.
Okay, you're still not going to go shop for your spouse. But we stop shopping, we stop traveling, we stop going to movies, we stop going to dinner with friends. We stopped kissing. I'm not going to say go kiss yourself, but you may have grandkids. Okay, I kiss on my grandbabies. Okay, some of them don't like it, but I still kiss on them. But we need to go back, brothers and sisters, and we need to say, okay, We need to go back and do the things that we can do that fill our reservoir. And for those of you that you got things that you can't do, like you can't kiss your spouse, okay? You got to go find some new things to do to fill your reservoir. On your sheet there is times. Okay, there's times on your sheet. And I want you to, and we're just going to do a couple here because we got about 6 minutes left. We're just going to do a couple of times so you'll see how it works. Okay, now if you only had 5 minutes time, 5 minutes to do whatever you wanted to do that you could fill your reservoir, what kind of things would you do? Kiss on grandkids. Give me more.
Go hiking.
Go hiking. You can't do that in 5 minutes, or can you? I don't be able to make. Well, I limp too, so I could go for a walk around my house twice. Okay, what else? What?
Read scriptures.
Sewing. Can you sew in 5 minutes? You can get the sewing machine out almost.
Eat a candy bar.
Eat a candy bar. Sing a song. Eat a donut. Okay, any of you have cell phones? Do you guys know how to text yet? Okay, learn how to text because your grandkids won't talk to you on the phone. They'll text you. Okay, my granddaughter says, Grandpa, you call all the time. I'm not answering you. And I says, why not? Because I don't talk on the phone. I says, can I text you? No, I don't text either. Okay, I have to do Snapchat. Okay, I only do it because why? Because I've got a teenage granddaughter that says that's all I'm going to do. And that's how she does. I just was released as a singles ward bishopric. And it was the weirdest thing that I could call 30 kids to talk in church. Nobody would answer my phone. I could send a text within seconds. Guess what they'd do? They would reply back. Weirdest thing in the world. They would not talk on the phone, but they will text me. So it's one of those things that you can text somebody in 5 minutes. You can pick up your phone and you can call somebody in 5 minutes. I want you to write these things down, okay? And what I want you to do on your cell phone is there's this little thing, again, on phones. It's called notes. You go into your notes and guess what you write? 5 minutes, and then you list everything that you can do in 5 minutes. I have 13 pages in my cell phone of things that I can do in these amounts of time. The reason that we do that is because there you are, you've got 5 minutes time, and you're thinking, what'll I do, what'll I do, what'll I do, what'll I do, and you cannot think about it, and now the 5 minutes are gone, and instead of filling your reservoir, you've drained your reservoir because you stressed out because you couldn't think of what to do, and now you go to your phone and you just look down and say, I can go and walk my dog. I can go and call my grandson. I can go and watch a little videoette that my daughter sent me of one of my grandchildren doing something cute, because they constantly send us those things, don't they? All right? Yes. Reservoir bucket list. I like that. Okay? Call it your reservoir bucket list at the top of your notes. Okay, now we're going to shift. I want you to go and say, okay, we now have an hour to do whatever we want to do. What would you do if you had a whole hour to do whatever you wanted to do? Workouts, exercise, more. Have a conversation with your son. Good one. Guess what I did all the drive down this morning? Okay, I didn't work in the flower beds, but I did talk to my son. But work in the flower beds. Write a letter. Take a bath. My wife's favorite thing to do is take a bath and read a book. Work on family history. Good one. Go to dinner with a friend. Okay, all of these things are excellent and wonderful ideas. Write them down if it's something that makes you feel good. Okay, I had a lady once that said it makes me feel good to clean out a drawer. It never has made me feel good to clean out a drawer, just so you know. And I had another lady that said she can paint her toenails. I've never been feeling good about painting toenails. But you have to find the things that make you feel good. Okay, now let's get to some tough ones. What if you had an evening to do whatever you wanted to do? What would you do? So there's a good one, genealogy. What would you do? We can go to the temple. Now, did you notice all of a sudden nobody's saying anything? Read a book. But the reason that people are not saying much is because guess what we used to do with our spouse? We used to spend the evening. And now we don't spend the evening doing anything anymore but sitting home and thinking about my spouse, or I'm not doing anything, or nobody loves me, nobody cares about me, I'm going to go eat worms and die.
He said it's easy to find somebody that will spend an hour with you and you don't feel like you're robbing them of their time. But to find somebody to spend a whole evening with, you feel like you're invading somebody's time, or sometimes you just don't want it, yeah, or that you're needy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How many of you have felt those same thoughts and feelings? I'm hoping that everyone would raise. Thank you for bringing that up, because that was actually the last thing I wanted to talk about. Just so you know, they never will. Mm-hmm. They never will, because they're not in your shoes. And you have to teach them if they let you. Most of them really won't let you, because what they want you to do is be really happy all the time. And then if you come and you're a downer, then they try to slap you around a little bit and make you feel all good and warm and fuzzy. But what Mary is talking about is what I call guilt. So can I label it for you? Is that we feel guilty that we're going to be the fifth wheel or the eighth wheel, the seventh wheel, and that they really don't want us, and we make people feel uncomfortable. I want you to know, first of all, the thoughts in your head about making people feel uncomfortable, after the first 3 or 4 months, that will make them feel uncomfortable, but after that, they don't. And it's all in your own mind. The guilt that you're feeling, though, and that's what I want to talk about with you here, the guilt that you feel is actually a crack in your reservoir, and it constantly drains out unless you plug it. All right? The guilt that you're feeling is what I call bad guilt. Okay? Bad guilt is guilt that you bring upon yourself. Bad guilt is guilt that you bring because you do the thinking for other people. Okay? Understand that if you invite somebody to go out to dinner with you, or you invite somebody to go to the show with you, and they say yes, but you're feeling guilty, that's guilt that you're bringing on yourself. If somebody invites you to go out to dinner or to a movie or to come go to the ballet or to a play or to a musical or something, the reason they're inviting you is why? They want to. They are not feeling obligated to. They're wanting you to come be with them. And so what you do with bad guilt, because bad guilt is guilt that you cannot fix. All right, that's how you determine whether it's good guilt or bad guilt. Bad guilt you can't fix. Good guilt you can. Good guilt you can. Good guilt is given to you by your Heavenly Father, and you can fix it. Bad guilt comes upon us because you bring it upon yourself, and you can't fix it. So you take it, wad it up, poof, throw it in the garbage. Or if it's, for example, let's pretend that your son invites you to go to dinner with him and his wife tonight. You can go and say, you know, hon, do you really want us to go, or are you just doing this because you feel obligated? And he's going to say, Mom, I really want you to go, or Dad, I really want you to go. And then you take it at face value, believe what he's saying, because they really do want you to be there. Now, our time is shot. I will be here for the next 3 days. If any of you have any questions, anything that you want to talk about, I am here. I want you to know that even though I don't understand everything that you're going through, because I have not lost my spouse, I do want you to know that I do love you, and I do know you, and I do pray for you daily. And I say that in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.